Welcome to Experiential Marketing Today.
Welcome to this episode of Experiential Marketing Today. This show is about the theory and practice of using experiences to engage audiences with the authentic nature of a brand or company. We believe that it may be the most powerful tool marketers have, but it's also something of a mystery. My name is Luke Fleener. I'll be your host for this episode. Episode 9, Design with Heart by Robin Waters. The sixth stop on the 2008 Event Marketing Innovation Tour was in our backyard of Nashville, Tennessee. The venue was the Performance Hall of the Musicians Hall of Fame. The Event Marketing Innovation Tour is a 9-city tour, showcasing the latest tools and innovations in event marketing. Attendees are typically executives with some level of responsibility for marketing. The keynote speaker for all 9 stops of this tour was Robin Waters. The following is her complete presentation from the Nashville event, which is about an hour long. We've also included some of the visuals from her presentation, which you will be able to see if you are listening to the enhanced version of this content. These images are also available in the show notes on our website. We now join the event in progress as John Robertson introduces Robin.
Robin Waters is a noted author and former vice president of trend, design, and product development for Target. She is the author of the Trendmaster's Guide, Get a Jump on What Your Customer Wants Next, and the book she'll be signing tonight, The Hummer and the Mini, Navigating the Contradictions of the New Trend Landscape. And she's a contributing author, along with Tom Peters, Seth Godin, and Malcolm Gladwell, for The Big Moo from Portfolio, which is a member of the Penguin Group. Robin has over 30 years' experience tracking and translating trends into sales and profit. And as Target's former VP, she helped a small regional discount chain become a national fashion destination. Fast Company magazine in 2004 featured Robin as one of the top 20 creative mavericks in their June 04 Masters of Design issue. Now, I got to tell you, we searched the country for a speaker for our immersive event whose last name was Waters. And you are the benefactors. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the stage, her first time in Nashville, Robin Waters.
Thank you very much. Well, good evening, everyone. It is great to be here in Nashville, and this is my first visit here. I've been to a lot of cities and a lot of countries, and I had the whole morning to explore, and I really enjoyed it. So I'm also lucky because this is the 6th city out of 9. I have 3 more left to go. And what I've been doing is traveling around talking about 2 of my favorite subjects, and that would be innovation and design. You know, in order to innovate, you have to do something different. You have to reframe your perspective. You have to change how you look at things. And that's one of the reasons why I love this visual, which was one of the promotions for the tour that I'm on, the innovation tour for the ADA. It's this guy in this chair looking upside down. And I talk about how do you turn things upside down or inside out. And in order to innovate, you need to do that. But then you need to convince people to change their behavior. And to convince people to make a change is very difficult. And so I like to quote Aristotle. He said, "You don't persuade people through intellect, you do so through emotion." And that's what the idea of this event that you're immersed in tonight is meant to do, is to engage you emotionally. And that's also what Design with Heart is all about, which is the title of my talk. I want to talk to you about reframing things, first of all, and give you an example. You heard me referred to as a trendmaster. That means that I track and translate trends into sales and profit. But when I started in the trend world, trend used to be about finding the next big thing. Everybody was on this holy grail search for what's next. And what I did at Target, and what made me successful and helped the company become Target, is I turned that inside out and said, and I actually landed on Starbucks cups around the world with my quote, and I'll share that with you in a minute. But I was author's quote number 110 in Starbucks' White Cup author series, and I was in between Herbie Hancock and Alice Hoffman, so I was in really nice company. Not only that, that was at the time when Starbucks was pouring 4 million cups of coffee every single day around the world. That's really nice marketing. And so here's my quote. "Trends are signposts pointing to what's going on inside the hearts and minds of the customer. These days, if you want to be on trend, It's more important to figure out what's important, not just what's next. Now, that's a subtle reframing. Prior to this, my coming out with this trend from the inside out philosophy, trend was always about what's next, what's out there. And I've turned that around. I've turned that inside out. And so what I'm really going to do is take you on a journey into the heart today. And my presentation, Design with Heart, is built around the idea that in order to connect with a customer or a client or an audience, you have to engage with them in an emotional way. You have to open up your heart, and you have to deliver good design. That design can be a well-designed event, such as you're enjoying tonight. It can be a beautifully designed product. It can be a fabulously designed marketing presentation. And it can also be a beautifully designed corporate mission. And I'm going to talk about all of those and how they relate to Design with Heart. A couple of comments about design. You know, good design can make your life better. It can solve problems. It can fix things. It can deliver on your needs. But great design can truly make your life better and make you happier. And Design with Heart can deliver beauty, not just to a product or an event, but to the bottom line. And that's what we're all here for. We're all here to make money. And so even though I'm going to talk a lot about the soft stuff today, I'm still going to deliver ideas that will help generate a very strong bottom line. So first, I want to talk about the state of the market. We are going to go out there and look out into the marketplace and just talk about what's going on out there in the customer's mind, in the market. First thing I want to talk about is a claustrophobia of abundance. This is what we're all faced with. When you go to the mall and you have so many choices, or you go to the grocery store and you have so many options, the pundits call this the claustrophobia of abundance. There's a lot of stuff out there. And where do we get that stuff? Well, we shop at a mall. We go to a store. There are big box stores on every corner. The malls are getting bigger than ever. In my backyard in Minneapolis, we have the Mall of America. There's 4,000 miles of square footage in terms of storefronts, and it's so big it has its own zip code. So we have big stores, but you know, if you can't get to a store, you don't want to get in your car and drive, just sit down at your desk, access the internet. The internet shopping has made the whole click and mortar business really important. And it's the idea that all you really need is a credit card and you have access to the world and you can purchase and select from just about anything. To give you an idea of what I mean by claustrophobia of abundance, let's say that you woke up this morning and you decided you wanted a new breakfast cereal. You were tired of the one you've been eating for the last several years or months. So you go to the grocery store. How many options would you think at your average grocery store you have in order to select a new breakfast cereal? Any thoughts in the audience? How many options? 70, 50, 300. 300, and that's your average supermarket. That's not your big box supermarket. So let's say you're this woman, and you're standing there, and you're looking at 300 options of breakfast cereal. How do you decide what you're going to buy? And what happens for a lot of people is they look at all those options, and they freeze. They freeze because there's too many options, and they're worried that they're going to make the wrong choice, so they decide not to decide, and they walk away. And that's a missed opportunity and a missed sale. And it's the idea, it's called the paradox of choice. Too many things to choose from, don't want to make the wrong choice, so I'll just stick with my usual. How do you get people to make a change? How do you get them to innovate? You reach to them, to their hearts, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But first, I want to talk about the contradictory consumer. Who is this customer that we're talking about? My book is called The Hummer and the Mini, Navigating the Contradictions of the New Trend Landscape. And here's what I mean by contradictions. I have a girlfriend, Lori. She wears Prada shoes, and she drives a Mercedes, but she goes to Costco every other week to buy her bulk paper goods. That's considered normal consumer behavior. Here's another example of the contradictory behavior, and this might be someone that you know. I have neighbors that are passionate about recycling, and every week they take their recycle carts down to the end of the driveway, and they're all neatly sorted. And then when it's been picked up, they push the carts back up, open the garage doors, and there are two gas-guzzling SUVs sitting there in the driveway. That's contradictory, but it's also human behavior. So we're dealing with a very contradictory consumer with contradictory needs, and we're dealing with a marketplace full of abundance. Now I'm going to take a look at the state of innovation in business and in the world today. And I'm sure you've all been following the news and all of the very tough economic times that we're dealing with. And I think that there's not a time in our country's history when we could use innovation more than right now. We need to innovate a lot of new systems and structures. And it turns out that every 5 years, there's a meeting at Harvard, and it's an innovation meeting, and leaders from the top Fortune 500 companies are invited to attend. And it is polling them and asking them about innovation. And Alan Weber, who's the founder of Fast Company, attended one of the meetings. This was a couple of years ago. This was the last time the economy was crunching. And he came away a little disillusioned. And what he said was, when it comes to American business, the visionaries are the ones who are dying or at least losing their jobs. We're entering the season of the bean counter. And to many people, that might feel like what we're entering right now. It's time to cut back. It's time to hold back. But as you just heard John say, it might be an opportunity to really move ahead. And it's the idea that you have to be a visionary to get us out of the times that we're in. So at this leader, at this conference of business leaders, they were asked, how do you feel about innovation? And they said, absolutely, innovation is to be encouraged, but only if it pays off in 6 months. Well, you know, most lead times are a little longer than 6 months. Then the next question they said, or the leaders said, was, we value profits, but not ideas. Well, where does innovation come from? Where does the next opportunity come from? They come from ideas. And so if you don't value ideas and innovation, you're not going to get to the next level of profits. One of the reasons that I saw things change a lot out there in the corporate land is Six Sigma. And in my book, The Hummer and the Mini, I talk about trends and counter-trends. We have innovation and moving forward, and then we have Six Sigma and cutting back. For those of you that may not be familiar with what Six Sigma is, it's a military term. It has to do with cutting out defects, and it has to do with the left brain analytical side of things. It's the idea that you measure, you analyze, you look for a best method or process, and then that's how you do something. That works really well in run-of-the-mill assembly line procedures, but it doesn't work so good in creative businesses or in a market where you really need to get creative and really need to innovate. What Six Sigma does, this emphasis on left brain measurement and analysis, is it leads to something that I call analysis paralysis. You know, when I was at Target, we had all these studies, market basket reports, statistics, data that we could look at, and we would pore over the numbers, and we would try to determine what business decisions we should make. Who are we designing a product for? What should it look like? How many should we make? What should we charge? And oftentimes, I used to feel that by looking at the numbers so closely, we got so out of touch with the customer that we couldn't use our intuition and use our gut. And that was something that wasn't often valued in the corporate world, and I'm seeing that change, and I'll talk about that a little bit. What this led to, all of this emphasis on left brain and Six Sigma, was something that experts call analexia. It's a term you may not have heard. It is a societal disease, according to experts, and it means if it can't be counted, it doesn't count. What does that look like and what does that mean? Well, it means that if you can't give somebody a definitive numerical answer or reason to make a decision or buy something, then you're not going to make the decision and innovation is going to be cut. So if it can't be counted, it doesn't count. But I really like the way that Albert Einstein said this a little better. He said, not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. A lot of the experiential aspects of an event can't be counted. They can be measured, but there are things that go even deeper that you can't really explain with numbers or measurement and analysis. I love this example of this ad of a chocolate chip cookie. It was for a consulting company. It was about the optimization of chocolate chip cookies in the 21st century. So if you were using numbers and measurement and you were trying to explain how good this chocolate chip cookie was and why somebody should buy it, what would you be able to tell them? Well, you could tell them how many calories were in the chocolate chip cookie, how many chocolate chips were in it, how much it weighed, how many were in a bag, you know, what the ingredients weighed, how long it was cooked, what it cost, but none of those things could compare to the experience of smelling that chocolate chip cookie as it came out of the oven, tasting it as the chocolate chips were still melting in your mouth. It is really the experience and the optimization of that will encourage and convince people to try that chocolate chip cookie. You have to immerse them in the experience. Sometimes this was a tough sell at Target when we were trying to promote a new idea. Invariably, a merchant would say, yeah, but show me the numbers. Show me the numbers. Explain to me why this would work. And you can always give some data. You can always show some analysis. That's like a baseline. But you have to go beyond that. And that was what I became a cheerleader for. And so sometimes I tried to inject a little bit of humor into my presentations where I was trying to convince them to try a new idea. And I gave them this quote. It's from W.C. Fields. He said, statistics are like bikinis. What they reveal is important, but what they hide is vital. So think of that the next time you go to the beach. But think of that the next time you are sitting in your office and you are looking at a report, you're looking at numbers, you're looking at data, and you're trying to figure out, what do I do? What decisions should I make? How do I know what direction to go in? Look at the numbers. Absolutely. They will help you make a decision, but then look further. Ask yourself what they're not telling you. What are the numbers hiding? What are they not revealing about what's really important in their inside to the customer? And I think that that's where you'll really be able to immerse yourself and find some innovative solutions and get to design with heart. So what I'm going to talk about now is the idea that we have two sides of the brain. I talk a lot about analytical left brain measurement analysis, and then talk about the right brain, which is the heart and the gut and the instinct. That's our senses and that's our creativity. The other side is our logic and our rationale and our reasoning. And what you really need is to bring both together. But in truth, in the business world, this is how things are valued. The left brain has been very much valued. MBAs coming out of school tend to be hired at higher salaries. The creative world has not fared so well. But thankfully, that's beginning to change, and I feel that I was on the cutting edge of that at Target, and what we're really getting to is the idea we have to use both sides of the brain. We have to even things out. So now we're going to do an interactive test, and this is called the F-test. This is a little glimpse of this is a test of observation. I want you to read the sentence in the box quietly to yourself and count how many Fs are in that sentence in the box, and then just kind of keep that number to yourself. Maybe look at it again. How many Fs are inside that sentence in the box? Okay, show of hands. How many people found three Fs? Raise your hand. At least half the audience. How many people found four Fs? Raise your hand. 8, 10 people. How many people found five Fs? Raise your hand. 5 or 6 people. How many people found six Fs? Raise your hand. 7, 8. We're all looking at the same thing. It's right there in black and white. It's a sentence. Why did we all see something different and most people didn't find all six of the Fs? Here they are. What happened? What happened was you were moving pretty fast and your left brain weighed in and it listened to of and it heard OV, even though it's OF. And this is just a great example of how we observe things. We're all looking at the same thing. And remember this the next time you're at a meeting and you're discussing options or trying to convince somebody of something and you all really see something different. And that's what happens when the left brain is too heavily valued. You miss some of the things surrounding it, and you jump to conclusions. So this is what I want to advocate for, and this is where design with heart begins to play in, because you have to put some of that intuition and sensory and feeling into the business decisions beyond the measurement, the analysis, and the logic. That's a lot of what drove Target's success. If you think about it, prior to Target becoming the upscale discounter, you had two forms of shopping, basically. You had a department store, which was high-end, and you had the discounter that was low-end and budget. And there was really not a whole lot in the middle. And what Target decided to do was carve out, reframe the retail landscape. And I'll tell you that Target, Walmart, and Kmart were all started in the same year. And when I came to Target in 1992, it was a $3 billion retailer, and Walmart was 10 times bigger, and Kmart was 3 times bigger. So we were the small, you know, unnoticed regional retailer out there. And what happened at this time in 92 was a really big reframing of the opportunity, and it was the idea that the CEO said, we have to create a different kind of retailing experience. So it became about the experience, and we're going to create this world in between that we call the upscale discounter space. And if you think of the brand promise at Target, which is expect more, pay less, that's a disconnect in many ways, although they managed to make it a connect. It's the idea that you can expect more trend, more design, more quality, more fashion at Target, but you're going to pay less for it than you would at not just a discounter like Walmart or Kmart, but if you were buying the same thing at a Gap or a Banana Republic or a Crate and Barrel. So people often ask me, how did that bullseye become the love mark? That's the highest thing a brand can aspire to. How did the Target bullseye become a love mark? And how did Target become Target? And it was really pretty simple, and it's no secret formula. There were three legs to the stool that really was the foundation of Target becoming Target. And the first is that they decided they would be trend right, not trend forward. but trend right. And so we had teams of people that traveled the world tracking trends. But the second was that they would be guest-focused, and this came out of the Disney tradition. It was about focusing on the customers in the store as though they were guests in your home. And so the idea was to track the trends but translate them for the guest, and then design became the secret sauce. Design was the tool. It was the pencil. It was the colored crayon that we used to differentiate and create unique product that helped an upscale discounter become as well-known as Target and drove a lot of sales. During my years there, I hired the first designer. I hired the 100th designer. Many more have been hired, and these are product designers, people that design all that cool stuff when you see when you go into a Target. And we hired a lot of young people fresh out of school, and we needed to instill in them the idea that we want their passion, we want their love of design to come through, because a young designer comes out of design school, they want to light the world on fire with all their great ideas. But at the same time, we had to get across the idea, you have to sell a lot of this. You know, we're a discounter. We need to sell a lot. This is a mass merchandiser. So I came up with this philosophy that ultimately in-house became known as Robin's 3H design theory. And the idea behind this is that we would talk about what would bring people into Target to buy something. What would motivate a shopper to come to Target on any given day? And the 3Hs stood for head, handbag, and heart. And the first H was for head, and it was about need. It was, you know, you wake up and the toothpaste tube is empty, so you have to run out and buy new toothpaste at Target. The handbag was about value. It was about, oh, it's in the circular, it's on sale, or maybe you push that red cart by a price cut sign, and it was a great value, so in the shopping cart it went. But the third H was for heart, and that was about you see something that you didn't know existed, that you don't need, but you see it and you look at it and you go, oh, look at that. I love that. I have to have that. I want that. That's falling in love with the product. And people often, in my years of travel, that I've traveled around the country, and when I was at Target, people would say, why is it that when I go to Target and I have three things on my list and I'm planning to spend $10, and I walk into the store and I go around all those nicely, you know, lit, clean, broad aisles, and why is it when I get to the checkout, I've spent, what, average? $100, right? $10 planned spend, $100 in the cart when you check out. What is that? What's the magic? How did that happen? Well, how that happened is that Target created this incredible experience built around design with heart. And it connected on an emotional level with customers about things that they didn't even know they needed and never even knew before that they existed. So it's this design with heart, the 3H head, hand, and heart theory that literally brought me to this idea or this concept that I'm talking about tonight, which is design with heart. And again, it's an emotional connection with the customer. So I'm going to talk about several categories: how you can design a product with heart, how you can design a service, an experience, a marketing message, and a social mission with heart. And I'm going to give you some examples from my history and from just looking out at the general world of trends out there. Tom Peters is a management guru, is one of my heroes, and in his latest book, Reimagination, he said, design is the fundamental soul of a man-made object. It's why we love something. This was my favorite object in the 10 and a half years I worked at Target, my favorite product that we designed, and this was a sippy cup from Philippe Starck. And if you notice, it's on a pedestal, and it looks like it's made out of cut crystal, and it has loving cup handles. And I will tell you that innovation-wise, this was pretty out there, because sippy cups don't come on pedestals, they're not clear, and they don't look like that. And when Philippe Starck recommended this product to the Target buyers, they were totally negative on the idea. They just, you know, the eyelids went down, and they're like, no, no way, we're not doing that product. But he was very passionate about this. So he created a prototype, and he filled it with grape juice, and he put it on the table in front of the buyers at Target, and then he accidentally spilled it over. He created an experience for them. And what happened was the grape juice didn't spill. The buyers pushed away from the table, afraid that the grape juice would spill, and nothing happened. And he looked at them and he said, see, it's functional. It works. The sippy cup didn't spill, but that's not why you should buy this. And then he took a picture out of his pocket of his little girl, a daughter who was 2 years old, and he says, this is why you should buy this. And he said, every little girl should feel like a princess when she drinks her apple juice out of a Philippe Starck sippy cup. She should feel just like mom and dad do when they drink their Veuve Clicquot champagne out of a cut crystal Waterford champagne flute. It's how you feel. It's not what the product is or what it does. It's the experience that she has drinking this apple juice. Well, a little bit of history behind this product. It retailed for $3.49. We unveiled this product in Milan at a major international design show. There were no targets in Europe. There were no international targets. Actually, there still are not today. And we really had no business being here at this very high-end design show. But we wanted to show the world how we felt about design. So we created this box. It's a very simple plywood box, and it sat in the middle of the fairgrounds at the Fiera, where if you got out of a taxi or came out of the mass transportation system, you had to walk by this box in order to get into the entrance hall of where this big international design fair was playing. And you can see the question, is design an elitist exercise or a democratic statement? That stopped a lot of designers and a lot of the press and media in their tracks. And the little window that you see there had a slideshow. And all 50 products of the Philippe Starck design program were shown on the screen with a price point. And the sippy cup was one of 50 items in that show. And the last slide said, visit our booth at such and such a station in order to get a press kit. But we still knew, even with that great box, which wasn't all that attractive, it was meant to be very low-key, that we had to attract people. So the designers did something very interesting. They injected sound into the experience. And so when you got out of your taxi and you were walking towards the Fiera, you heard this ba-boom, ba-boom. It was a heartbeat. And it literally worked like a magnet. It just drew people over to the window. And then you hoped they would stay long enough to see the whole slideshow, see all the products, and then go to the booth to pick up the press kit. How did that work? What were the results? How did we measure that? Well, when I got home from my two-week trip overseas, I was inundated with emails from around the world. I had emails from New Zealand. I had them from Denmark, from the UK, from Vancouver, from all over the world. People that had seen the slideshow, stayed to watch the end, gone in, gotten a press kit, and found my name buried in the back of the kit. And they emailed me, and they said, "Dear Ms. Waters, I have to have one of those Philippe Starck sippy cups." Now, Target.com wasn't up and running. We were just a brick-and-mortar retailer. We weren't in the internet business. Even if we were, logically, you take a $3.49 item, convert it to euros or Deutschmark or British pounds, and then charge somebody $20 or more to ship it overseas, that makes no logical, numerical, analytical sense. So what I did, since we weren't set up for international retail, was I went out with my assistant and I bought samples of for as many people as I had gotten emails from, and I sent them a sippy cup, and I wrote them a handwritten note on really cool Target Bullseye stationery, and I said, "Dear so-and-so, thank you for your love of Target and your interest in great design. I hope your niece, nephew, daughter, granddaughter, fill in the blank, will enjoy this little gift from Target, and maybe someday there'll be a Target in your part of the world," and I sent them off. What's interesting is that I used to have a sample that I would bring when I to my talks around the country, and I used to put it on the podium. And a couple of months ago, I finished a talk. It was a very large audience in an auditorium, and I went down off the stage afterwards to talk to people in the audience. And 10 minutes later, I went back up to get my laptop, and it was still there, but my sippy cup had disappeared. It was stolen. Somebody had to have that so bad. They fell in love with that so much that they stole it off the podium. Now, I've since been told I can go on eBay and I can replace it if I'm willing to spend at least $50. So I think $3.49 to $50, that's the value of design with heart. So what would that look like for some other products? This is one of the reasons why I named my book The Hummer and the Mini. I'm just infatuated with not only the product but the marketing behind this. I shot this photograph in Times Square the year that Mini Cooper was announced, brought to the U.S. And you may remember that when they first were brought to our country, there weren't a lot of dealerships where you could go to a Mini Cooper, pay your money, and ride one out of the store, drive one out of the store. Instead, you went online, and you custom designed your own car. You chose from 150 different options. What the Mini Cooper company did was they created a virtual connection through the internet with you where you could create your own car and make it unique, make it totally for you. But in order to do that, you had to wait 8 to 12 weeks to get your custom designed car. And you all know that in America, we don't like to wait for anything. We don't like to wait an extra 2 minutes for a cup of coffee. So the company created an online program where the customer could go and any time of the day or night find out where their car was. They could see the new paint job. They could see when it was being put on the ship to be sent overseas. They could see when it rolled into the dealership. I have a girlfriend who is awaiting the arrival of her new Mini Cooper. She got an email last week from her car. Her car emailed her from the ship with a photograph saying, "I'm here on board, we're partying, having a great time, can't wait to meet you." Can you imagine how that made her feel? And what's cool is that now when you order a Mini Cooper, the last email you get is a JPEG of your car and birth announcements. So you can send out birth announcements to all your friends, announce the new arrival in your garage. What's interesting is that now they call this program "Where's My Baby?" Because the research afterwards showed that when they polled the people that ordered the Mini Coopers, they found out that over half of them, during this 8 to 12 week birth canal process, ended up giving their car a first name. Is there a better way to create an emotional connection or bond with a product than to be able to give it a name? And so it's, I think it's just a stellar example of a company that took the design of a product and the marketing of it and the interactive aspect of it to create a product that had great heart. This is Stan the Singing Starfish. This was a toothbrush holder that a young designer at Target created. It was her first design project. And when she came up with the idea, most bathroom collections were made out of wicker or stainless steel, chrome, maybe bamboo. And she came up with the idea to make one out of plastic, and she called the whole collection Below the Bubbles. And this was long before SpongeBob SquarePants or The Little Mermaid. And so she gave each one of them a name, and this was Stan. And the buyers, when she unveiled this idea, were sort of like, "Oh, I don't know, that's kind of crazy." But she had the numbers. She had the left brain satisfied. She had done research that showed that over half the homes in America have bathrooms that are dedicated just for children. And so she had some numbers to support it. And then she did something really interesting. She demonstrated the product, and she had the buyer push the button in the tummy of the singing starfish, and Stan started to sing. And it sang, "Brush, brush, brush your teeth, brush them every day." And it was a little song that Jill had composed, and it went for 1 minute, which is the length of time the American Dental Association suggests that kids spend brushing their teeth. And when she pressed that button and the sound came out, the buyer's faces lit up in a big smile. And that's, I think, right at that moment that they decided, yeah, we'll take a risk. We'll do something innovative. We'll try something different. And that product retailed for under $8, and it was some of the best grandma bait that we ever had at Target. It flew off the shelves. A quick example about the power of packaging. You're in a beautiful room environment that's been packaged for every aspect of your comfort and your delight. But how you package a product can provide that same experience. This is a perfume designed by Prada. Prada is a very fashion-forward, cutting-edge designer line for men and women. And when they came out with their first fragrance, they decided to put it in this heavy, rectangular, clear, iconic glass bottle. But they went to the additional expense to put out this old-fashioned atomizer. It was just like the perfumes from the Hollywood glamour era of the 30s and 40s. And, of course, the perfume was a lovely scent, and it was researched well. But what's interesting is that the message it was giving to the woman who bought this was, you can be cutting edge and modern, but you can still be nostalgic and glamorous. You can have both. It's the contradictions it played to. The fragrance went on to become one of the top 5 sellers in the country and around the world. It still is in the top ranking. And this is at a time when 99 out of 100 new fragrances that are launched every single year disappear a year later. It's like the celebrity du jour, they just fall off the radar. And this has become an icon, just like Coco Chanel or Chanel No. 5. And I'm not saying it's exclusively because of the packaging, but the experience that the packaging created had a lot to do with the emotional connection of the woman to that fragrance, and it kept her coming back. I'm going to talk briefly about designing a service with heart. And I thought about all different kinds of services I could talk about. I could talk about banking. I could talk about car washes. I could talk about, well, how about a hospital? So this is an interesting article from Fast Company magazine. You may have heard the term medical tourism. It's something you'll be hearing more about. It's the idea that your next heart surgery could well be in Bangkok, but don't worry, it may well be in network. So What is this all about? And imagine the service you go to get. Your health is on the line and you when you go to a hospital. This is a hospital in Bangkok, Thailand. It's called Bumrungrad Hospital. It was featured on 60 Minutes last year. On the left is the lobby. The lobby looks like an upscale mall or a five-star hotel when you walk in. And on the right is the waiting room. Not too many hospital waiting rooms look like that. And I'm told that the outpatient clinic is ritzier even than the bar at your local five-star hotel. So here's a hospital experience that has all the outward rigging of a great experience, but inward, it's also stellar. Because what happens is people come from around the world to have a treatment. It could be anything from a hip replacement to open-heart surgery. And I'm sure that's sounding a little bit crazy to you. So here's a hospital that's built around that. They were the first hospital in the world to convert all of their records online so that any doctor had instantaneous training. In this hospital are doctors that were trained in the U.S., did their residency in the U.S., and are dealing with the top-notch medical equipment that is, created around the world. And I'm betting that you're still thinking, yeah, but I'm going to go to Bangkok for, a procedure. Well, here's some statistics for you. A colonoscopy, the average cost in the U.S. is $3,500. At this hospital, which is one of the top-ranked in the world, it's $750. If you think about the difference and you think about, what you could do with that difference, or, you could add a trip to Phuket on to the back end of your surgery and or your procedure. And it's the whole idea of reinventing, reframing the world of healthcare. This is globalized healthcare. And if you're sitting in the audience saying, I'm not ever getting on a plane to go to Bangkok to have a procedure done, I'll tell you two things. One is that our hospital system in the U.S. is ranked number 37 by the WHO, World Health Organization. Singapore and Costa Rica are the top two. There are other places in the world to have great health care. And first of all, this might inspire us to deliver better health care. But beyond that, I'm sure there, are people that are saying, I still wouldn't go out of the country to have this done. But I would bet that many of your parents, when they were driving Fords and Chevys, never thought they'd be owning a car made in Japan or Korea or another place around the world. So it's the service built around this hospital. And the patients rave about the bedside manner, and they also rave about the entire experience. So it's a service as well as an experience that's been delivered. Moving into an experience, I want to talk a little bit about Steve Jobs and Apple. And, of course, anytime you're talking about design, Apple as a brand is at the top of the list. And there are a lot of Steve Jobs stories out there that you've probably heard. But I'm betting you haven't heard this one. When Steve introduced the Apple OS X operating system at Macworld in San Francisco, he was asked by a reporter, "So, Steve, what makes this using this OS X operating system a better experience than, Windows or anything else?" And he said, "What did you tell your designers when they were thinking about designing this?" And Steve said, "I told them to make the buttons on the screen look so good that you'd want to lick them." Interesting. Look at the iPhone. It looks like a box of fine, high-end, European chocolates. Now, the term on the bottom of the screen is French. It literal translation is lick the window, but it's the French translation means window shopping. And the idea of window shopping is about desire. You're walking along and you see something in the window and you stop and you practically drool because you desire it, you want it. And that's the essence of what he was communicating about the design behind the experience he wanted the user to have when they used the OS X operating system. Some of you may know about Apple's one-to-one program. For $99, you get an hour instruction each week of the year, and this could be at any Apple store around the world. And a couple of weeks ago, I wanted to learn Keynote. I've been using PowerPoint, and I went for my one-on-one hour demonstration where you sit right next to an instructor, you bring your laptop, and you learn this new system on your computer. And at one point, my instructor was trying to show me something to do that I couldn't do on my laptop. And he went right to the big screen right next door. So this is a, right there interactive experience. And with one click of the mouse, he showed me this incredible shortcut that was so cool and so snazzy that I just looked at him and I go, how can I do that? And he said, well, you have iWork 06 and this is iWork 08. And it was like, well, how do I get that? And 2 minutes later, it was off the shelf, installed on my computer, they'd swiped my credit card, and the receipt had been emailed to my email address. And the whole idea is that if I hadn't been sitting there, you know, he could have told me, I could have read about it, but seeing it there right in front of my eyes, knowing that I could have it instantly, was probably the best use of that $99 that I'm still enjoying the learning from. So creating that interactive one-on-one experience has a lot to do with the polish behind the Apple brand. Some of you may have gone to Build-A-Bear. Anybody have taken kids, grandkids, Build-A-Bear? It's the idea that a child can go in and select stuff, stitch, and wardrobe their very own teddy bear. And what's the last thing, those of you that have done it, that happens when you do this, you select a name and you insert the heart. And it's that whole idea. Maxine Clark, the founder of Build-A-Bear, said it's that interactive experience of going through the store and customizing it and then inserting the heart and watching the bear, you know, being sewn up and the name being given to it, that makes that company such a powerful brand. It is, in fact, one of the most profitable per square foot mall anchors in the country. It's just a little toy store. I want to tell you an example now from your backyard here. And this is a project that was actually done by Advent for Healthway. Healthway asked Advent to create a total experience, just like John was talking about. They wanted the trade show exhibit, they wanted the brand space, and they wanted the event. And what they were doing was marketing, unveiling a new Gallup Healthways well-being index that I'll tell you a little bit more about in a moment. And what the company Healthways was trying to do was to promote the culture and values of their company and their brand, not just the product that they delivered. And here are some of the things that were done. This is the front entry, the brand space that John talked about when you walk in. By the way, I should tell you that Healthways is known as one of the top 100, in the Fortune 100, top 100 places to work in the country. So they have a very excellent working teammate culture. And when you walk in, this is what you see. You see this inspiring space with a person on the top of the hill. And it's about possibilities. It's about all the endless possibilities and bringing your entire self to work and giving your all to the company and what they will deliver back. And you can see on the right-hand side, there's a wall that's lit up. And what that is this is this Tom Cigarron Award for Value and Culture. And it's about the Employee of the Year award, in essence, and it embodies the values of the company. And the idea that the chairman and CEO wanted to give behind this is they wanted to make this really big. This wasn't a small plaque on a wall in a lobby or, you know, a front entry. So you can see this is taller than a person, and the names are literally up in lights. And they're signifying how much they value the contributions of the individual team members, the people that were selected, and that this is a company dedicated to the whole idea and philosophy behind giving your best and being inspiring. Speaking of inspiring, this is a conference room. I would have given my eye teeth to have a conference room like this at Target. And each of the conference rooms has a different theme and is named after a different value that the culture of Healthways wants to promote. In this case, inspiration. And you can see everything from the materials to the colors, the lighting, the screens that are over the window give you an atmosphere that is meant to be conducive to innovative. And I love the quote on the wall. It's from John Adams, and it says, "If your actions inspire others to dream more, to learn more, to do more, and become more, then you are a leader." And what this company is saying, that anybody can be a leader if you can inspire others. And I think that that's, I can just imagine what it would be like to come to work in a place where those were the values. The other leg of the what Advent provided for Healthways is the interactive booth at the trade show. It was the AHIP, the American Health Insurance Plan Conference. And the booth was meant to convey an outdoor feel with the carpeting that looked like grass. And on the right, you see trees that were provided by the Arbor Day Foundation, little evergreen trees. And what this did was make the display more interactive because the people that were manning the trade show exhibit for Healthways would give one of the trees to the people that entered the booth and talk about how we have to take care of our bodies and nurture them just like we have to nurture a tree in order for it to grow strong and become mature. So they had something to take away that then they had to nurture and care for. They had to take it home and plant. So you can see this whole immersed interactive experience is being built. But this was the ultimate event. They wanted to announce the Gallup Healthways Wellbeing Index. And if you're not familiar with that, I'll do my best to explain it. It's called the Dow Jones of Health Index for the country. And it was a project that Healthways and Gallup sponsored where 1,000 people are interviewed every day, 7 days a week, about the state of their health. And health is defined not just as lack of problems or disease, but are you happy? Are you living a good life? So this is a way for companies and the country literally to monitor the well-being. And so this was a big concept to get your arms around. It needed a really big event to promote it. So they did a red carpet event, and it was built around the idea of when Harry Winston delivered the Hope Diamond to the Smithsonian. They wanted a big event, red carpet. This was in San Francisco at the conference. And so they had a movie premiere night. They had red carpeting with fabulous lighting. And then they had clips from old movies that were being played on the wall. I think this is a little bit of the experience you're going to have tonight afterwards when you get to interact in all the fun things that are planned here. But what was cool is that they also had intimate spaces for cocktail where people could meet and talk. They had people that were lookalikes of celebrities that would interact. They had people drawing caricatures. And they had this interactive element where they literally let you participate and be pulled in this Gallup Healthways Index. It's a big idea, as I said, to get your arm around. And it was a big memorable event that people are still talking about. And I think it's a great example of this total package of the brand space, the trade show exhibit, and the event, the memorable event that pulls everything together and delivers a big message that connects right to the heart. I'm going to talk about designing a marketing message. For those of you that are interested in design or the power of creativity in business, this is a great book I recommend from Dan Pink called A Whole New Mind. It's about the left brain and the right brain working together. And he said, a new conceptual age is dawning. We've entered the age of art and heart. Here's a great example. This is a Starbucks marketing campaign for their holiday drinks. It came out a couple of years ago, and the cup down the side, familiar Starbucks cup in red, has the white boxes that say shots, syrup, decaf. But the one that's checked says one moment to myself. Starbucks isn't selling you coffee. They're not selling you premium, fair trade, expensive, environmentally friendly coffee. They are giving you a 5-minute vacation. They're delivering an experience, a coffee house experience, that they want you to feel is a little bit of peace of mind. There's a great book by Melinda Davis. It's called The New Culture of Desire, as in desiring things with your heart. And she says if you're a marketer these days, you're not just selling something. You need to be healing. You're a healer. And that's the idea, is by giving somebody this 1 minute, the one moment to yourself, that's contributing to the well-being of this individual. And that's a much bigger marketing promise than just a great cup of coffee. This is an ad that I just found this week from my hometown. Gabbert's is a furniture store. And you know, what is furniture? It's a couch to sit on, it's a television to watch, it's a new bed. But I think what Gabbert's did here was reframe it, and I'll read it. It says, invest in your nest in time for the holidays. Make your home a warm, entertaining, and nurturing refuge for your company. And it's the whole idea that it's not the stuff in it, it's how that stuff makes you feel, and how literally you're in a nest, and you're protected, and you're nurtured, and you invite people into your home, and you open your heart to them. That's a subtle communication that I think is not just about rush in and buy a couch today, but more about, you know, create a world that appeals to you and connects to your heart. This is a very interesting campaign for Harley Davidson. Any Harley riders? Any Harley Davidson riders? A couple, great. You may have seen this ad. When I first heard about it, So Screw It, Let's Ride, I was like, oh, I don't know about that. But I want to read this to you, and you can read along with me, because I changed my mind after I got the essence of the message. We don't do fear. Over the last 105 years in the saddle, we've seen wars, conflicts, depression, recession, resistance, and revolutions. We've watched 1,000 hand-wringing pundits disappear in the rearview mirror. But every time, this country has come out stronger than before. Boy, do we need to hear that right now, editorial. Because chrome and asphalt put distance between you and whatever the world can throw at you. Freedom and wind outlast hard times, and the rumble of an engine drowns out the spin on the evening news. If 105 years have proved one thing, it's that fear sucks. And it doesn't last long. So I'd ask you, do you think they're selling motorcycles here? Is that what they're selling? Are they healing? They're offering hope. This is a message about hope. This is a different way. And, you know, if you think about the who their audience is, they have the rubbies, the rich urban bikers, and they have the rebels, you know, the guys with the long hair and the tattoos, and they're all part of this Harley world, and it's very inclusive. How do you deliver a message that both ends will resonate with? You go right to the heart, and you deliver hope, not just the idea of, you know, come on in and buy a new bike. This example is a fun one. This is an example of a brand that is a market leader because they own the marketplace. They're first to market. Pampers, a P&G product, came out with the first disposable diaper, and they owned the market for 2 years. That was the only brand on the market. And their marketing campaign was Pampers makes mom happy. It was about convenience, and it was about making her life easier, and it was a well-designed product. 2 years later, Huggies is introduced by Kimberly Clark. So this is a competitor entering a market totally owned and dominated by an existing brand. And they're going to try to make some headroads. They created a better product. It had elastic legs. It had Velcro tab closures. It had better absorbency. But they were smart enough to know that those were only incremental design improvements. Eventually, P&G's designers and engineers would go to work and create a product just as good, maybe a little better. So Huggies and Kimberly Clark knew they had to create more behind the brand. So their marketing campaign became Huggies makes babies happy. What happens when babies are happy? Moms are happy too. And the whole idea of even the idea of a hug and putting your arms around somebody, the brand came from nowhere and beyond and went on to dominate the marketplace. Now they play back and forth. But whenever Kimberly Clark goes back to the making babies happy and the product is equal, the brands accelerate. And it's the whole idea of be very careful how you craft your marketing message. How can you connect it to the heart? This is my favorite example, though. The London Underground. For years, London had been a city with a premier mass transportation system, but right after 9/11, the ridership was falling off. Everybody that had a vehicle was driving into London. The parking spaces were full. The air was polluted. The roads were congested. And the city fathers said, "You know, we need to dust off and polish up our transportation system. We need more people to take mass transportation." So they spent a lot of money. They cleaned up the cars. They cleaned off the graffiti. They put new upholstery in. They installed wireless on the commuter cars that came in from the outlying towns. They took the old coffee and plastic cups away and established an espresso bar in the dining car. They did everything they could to raise the level of the experience of commuting mass transportation into London. And when they were done, they came out with this new marketing campaign, and it said, "The new London Underground, we get you to work faster." And nothing happened. Ridership stayed the same. They'd spent all this money, and they had no improvement in ridership. So they had a little bit of a problem. And somebody said, "You know, maybe we should talk to the customer. You know, we just did all of this. Let's find out what's important to them." And they hired teams of ethnographers, ethnographic researchers, and cultural anthropologists to just go out and talk to people. And a couple months later, they came out with a new marketing campaign. Nothing else changed. And the marketing campaign was this: "The new London Underground, we get you home faster." Ridership soared. Same cars on the same track, going back and forth every day. What mattered was not getting to work. That's going to happen anyway. What mattered was getting home. And what that really was a nod to the rider, connecting to the customer, the rider, and saying, "We know what's important, and we're going to help you take care of that. We're going to get you home faster." And I think it's just a great testament to the subtle power that a marketing message with heart can have to do in terms of measurable results. So now the last section is talking about designing a corporate mission, and I want to talk about something called social capitalism. It's a term you probably are familiar with. It's the last chapter in my book, The Hummer and the Mini, that you're all being given tonight. And it's a term that I didn't make up. It's been coined by Fortune, Forbes, Fast Company. All the business magazines talk about it. But it is a new idea, a fairly new idea, and it's the idea that you can do good and make money. It's about bringing goodness into a corporation, not just profits out of it. And this is a visual from Fortune magazine, and I love the visual because it shows a heart at every place in the boardroom. This is a boardroom. And the article went on to talk about we brought everything else into the boardroom. We've brought cultural diversity. We've brought efficiencies. We've brought Sarbanes-Oxley. We've brought all of these aspects into the boardroom. But now maybe it's time to bring heart. How do you bring heart into a boardroom? How do you bring heart to work every day? How do you create a great experience for your employees and your customers? And the example that I write about in my book is Paul Dolan, who was the fourth generation in a family of winemakers, Fetzer Vineyards, you may be familiar with from California. And Paul converted early to all natural organic winemaking methods. So he had biodiesel tractors and everything was all natural. And what he did was he wanted to run his company in a different way. And so he used and leveraged something that is called the triple bottom line. And you may or may not have heard of this. It's also called E3 or E cubed. And E3 stood for economics, can we make a profit? Environment, can we leave the environment as good as we found it or maybe even better? And equity. Equity was about paying people a fair wage, giving them great benefits, and giving them a reason beyond a paycheck to come to work. Can we make this a great experience for everybody? A lot like I can just tell from all the people I've met at Advent how great it is to work for a company like this. And it's the idea of taking care of their employees. And every question that he makes, every marketing decision he looks at, every cost analysis that he has to make a decision around, he puts against these three questions. And if you can say yes to all of them, he goes ahead and makes the decision. The E3, or triple bottom line, is now being taught at Kellogg, at Stanford, at the London School of Business. It's now part of the MBA program. And I think that that's an amazing testament to the fact that we have entered the age of art and heart. Just a couple last quick examples. Anita Roddick founded The Body Shop. Horst Reckelbacher founded Aveda. And Roxanne Quimby founded Burt's Bees. 10 years ago, when the business press talked about these guys, they referred to them as eccentric herbalist hippies. Today, L'Oreal owns The Body Shop. Estee Lauder has bought Aveda, and Clorox just bought Burt's Bees. Now the big guys are buying these little maverick rebels who had a different way of doing business. And you know what the business press now calls each of these three companies? They call them savvy business marketers. These were the companies that were first to understand about caring for the employee, about fair trade, about taking care of the environment, and about giving people a great place to work, not just a paycheck. So I think it's a great testament to social capitalism hard at work in our economy. Howard Schultz, when he founded Starbucks, it was a two-store startup, and he's going to venture cap, and he needs a lot of money to grow it into the powerhouse that it has become today. And in his first page on his business plan, he said, quote, "I want to make a profit in a benevolent manner." And that was unheard of in, you know, business plan lingo. And here was his rationale. It was about making money. It wasn't just about being altruistic. He said, "There will come a time in our world where when the customer goes to choose cup of coffee X, Y, Z." So in my neck of the woods, that would be Dunn Brothers, Caribou, and Starbucks. And maybe the fourth option is a local restaurant or diner. And the customer is walking down the street and they decide, "I want a cup of coffee." How do they decide where they'll go to buy that cup of coffee? He said, "All the coffees are good. All the ambiances are good. What will prompt their decision?" And he said it will come down to a cultural audit. And by cultural audit, he meant that before the decision is made where to buy that cup of coffee, the customer will ask themselves three questions. How does the company treat their employees? How do they give back to the community? And how do they take care of the environment? And based on those questions, that cultural audit, that's how they'll decide where to buy their cup of coffee. And I think, you know, Starbucks has grown tremendously. They're struggling now. They've grown a little too big. But the foundation of the company and the principles it was founded on are intact. So I've given you a lot of food for thought and a lot of examples from all different aspects. And these are the three questions I'd like you to take back in your mind with you when you go back to work tomorrow or Monday. Is every time you have a project, you can ask yourself not just how do I sell more of this or how do I make this better, but how do you inspire desire? How do you make people, how do you deliver something that people just have to have because they've fallen in love with it? The second is, Are there any rules that you need to break in order to create that desire and innovate and market that product? Because most of the examples that I've given you tonight are about people who broke the given rules of how something was done or how a business was run. And then what's tomorrow? What's the one thing you can do to reframe, to look at something different, to put it in a different context that you can look at and go back and just approach a little differently tomorrow morning? Gary Hamel, who's at the Harvard Business School, said, "The accountants and the engineers are going to have to learn to love the poets and the dreamers." All of the examples I gave you tonight and everything in this room is about poetry and about dreams and about delivering a better experience. And so hopefully what will come from all of this is that thriving versus surviving in today's marketplace mandates that you innovate in a way that connects on an emotional level. That's design with heart, designing a message, a product, a social mission. Design with heart will help you do that. And the last thing is, it's not how much you spend, but how will you connect. It's connecting in times like this that really make the difference. So thank you very much. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions that you might have. I've thrown a lot of information out at you. Any questions? Yeah, I think that the question is about the economic times and, you know, pay less. Of course, people want to pay less for whatever they get. But within that, there are still choices to be made. And some things will drop off. But still, when a purchase is made, it will have to be more emotionally engaging. It will have to connect on a higher level. I mean, if you know, things will drop by the wayside and people will forego certain things. But this is the time, I think, in terms of marketing, where people can stand out and deliver an experience because everybody else is dropping off and falling out. So you can turn this around and look at it as an opportunity. Or you can, you know, just kind of say, I'm going to pull back. But there's a great quote from Robert Redford. He said, "Growth is a creative process, not an accounting process. And even in these times, you have to be creative. And you can't cut your way to greatness. You can trim, but you can still find more effective ways." And I think the essence behind the whole idea of design with heart is whatever you have to spend, it needs to connect on an emotional level. It can't just be about, you know, more media or cooler things or more stuff out there. It has to be more meaningful, not just more. And that's that part of that expect more, pay less. And even though Target may be promoting more the pay less aspect of their brand promise, that customer has been trained to still expect more. And they're still talking about their design for all and a lot of their cool new products. But it will balance out a little differently. And I think that those companies that stand out in this time is connecting to what's important. Like, you know, we get you home faster, not just we get you to work faster. Those are the things that when times are tough, people resonate with more strongly. It's a very soft, subtle connection, but it's one that I think is imminently more powerful than just more stuff. Great. Well, I will be signing books here afterwards and be happy to answer any questions as well. So thanks very much.
We hope you enjoyed Robin's presentation. If you have any questions or comments about anything she discussed, you can email those to us using the address feedback@experientialmarketingtoday.com. You can also leave comments on the website using the space provided at the end of the show notes. Our website address is www.experientialmarketingtoday.com, where you'll also find links to resources related to Robin's presentation. If you prefer speaking over typing, you can leave your comment on our voice comment line. That number is 615-690-6796. We hope you'll join us for the next episode.
Thanks for listening to Experiential Marketing Today.